Chapter 22 Continued. "Is Mum here?" said Fred, turning to Sirius.
"She probably doesn't even know what's happened yet," said Sirius. "The important thing was to get you away before Umbridge could interfere. I expect Dumbledore's letting Molly know now."
"We've got to go to St. Mungo's," said Ginny urgently. She looked around at her brothers. They were, of course, still in their pyjamas. "Sirius, can you lend us cloaks or anything?"
"Hang on, you can't go tearing off to St. Mungo's," said Sirius. "Course we can go to St. Mungo's if we want," said Fred with a mulish expression. "He's our dad." "And how are you going to explain how you knew Arthur was attacked before the hospital even let his wife know?" "What does that matter?" said George hotly. "It matters because we don't want to draw attention to the fact that Harry is having visions of things that are happening hundreds of miles away," said Sirius angrily. "Have you any idea what the Ministry would make of that information?"
Fred and George looked as though they could not care less what the Ministry made of anything. Ron was still ashen-faced and silent.
Ginny said, "Somebody else could have told us. We could have heard it somewhere other than Harry."
"Like who?" said Sirius impatiently. "Listen, your dad's been hurt while on duty for the Order, and the circumstance is fishy enough without his children knowing about it seconds after it happened. You could seriously damage the Order's..."
"We don't care about the dumb Order," shouted Fred. "It's our dad dying we're talking about," yelled George. "Your father knew what he was getting into, and he won't thank you for messing things up for the Order," said Sirius, equally angry. "This is how it is. This is why you're not in the Order. You don't understand. There are things worth dying for." "Easy for you to say stuck here," bellowed Fred. "I don't see you risking your neck."
The little colour remaining in Sirius's face drained from it. He looked for a moment as though he would quite like to hit Fred, but when he spoke, it was in a voice of determined calm.
"I know it's hard, but we've all got to act as though we don't know anything yet. We've got to stay put, at least until we hear from your mother. All right?"
Fred and George still looked mutinous. Ginny, however, took a few steps over to the nearest chair and sank into it. Harry looked at Ron, who made a funny movement somewhere between a nod and a shrug, and they sat down too. The twins glared at Sirius for another minute, then took seats either side of Ginny.
"That's right," said Sirius encouragingly. "Come on, let's all have a drink while we're waiting. Axio Butterbeer."
He raised his wand as he spoke, and half a dozen bottles came flying towards them out of the pantry, skidded along the table, scattering the debris of Sirius's meal, and stopped neatly in front of the six of them. They all drank, and for a while the only sounds were those of the crackling of the kitchen fire and the soft thud of their bottles on the table. Harry was only drinking to have something to do with his hands. His stomach was full of horrible, hot, bubbling guilt. They would not be here if it were not for him. They would all still be asleep in bed. And it was no good telling himself that by raising the alarm he had ensured that Mr. Weasley was found, because there was also the inescapable business of it being he who had attacked Mr. Weasley in the first place.
"Don't be stupid. You haven't got fangs," he told himself, trying to keep calm, though the hand on his butterbeer bottle was shaking.
"You were lying in bed. He weren't attacking anyone." "But then, what just happened in Dumbledore's office?" he asked himself. "I felt like I wanted to attack Dumbledore, too."
He put the bottle down a little harder than he meant to, and it slopped over onto the table. No one took any notice. Then a burst of fire in midair illuminated the dirty plates in front of them, and, as they gave cries of shock, a scroll of parchment fell with a thud onto the table, accompanied by a single golden phoenix tail feather.
"Forks," said Sirius at once, snatching up the parchment. "That's not Dumbledore's writing. It must be a message from your mother. Here."
He thrust the letter into George's hand, who ripped it open and read aloud,
"Dad is still alive. I'm setting out for St. Mungo's now. Stay where you are. I will send news as soon as I can. Mum."
George looked around the table.
"Still alive," he said slowly. "But that makes it sound..."
He He did not need to finish the sentence. It sounded to Harry, too, as though Mr. Weasley was hovering somewhere between life and death. Still exceptionally pale, Ron stared at the back of his mother's letter as though it might speak words of comfort to him. Fred pulled the parchment out of George's hands and read it for himself, then looked up at Harry, who felt his hand shaking on his butterbeer bottle again and clenched it more tightly to stop the trembling. If Harry had ever sat through a longer night than this one, he could not remember it. Sirius suggested once, without any real conviction, that they all go to bed, but the Weasleys' looks of disgust were answer enough. They mostly sat in silence around the table, watching the candle wick sinking lower and lower into liquid wax, occasionally raising a bottle to their lips, speaking only to check the time, to wonder aloud what was happening, and to reassure each other that if there was bad news, they would know straight away, for Mrs. Weasley must long since have arrived at St. Mungo's. Fred fell into a doze, his head lolling sideways onto his shoulder. Ginny was curled like a cat on her chair, but her eyes were open. Harry could see them reflecting the firelight. Ron was sitting with his head in his hands, whether awake or asleep it was impossible to tell. Harry and Sirius looked at each other every so often, intruders upon the family grief, waiting, waiting. At 5:10 in the morning by Ron's watch, the kitchen door swung open and Mrs. Weasley entered the kitchen. She was extremely pale, but when they all turned to look at her, Fred, Ron and Harry, half rising from their chairs, she gave a wan smile. "He's going to be all right," she said, her voice weak with tiredness. "He's sleeping. We can all go and see him later. Bill's sitting with him now. He's going to take the morning off work." Fred fell back into his chair with his hands over his face. George and Ginny got up, walked swiftly over to their mother, and hugged her. Ron gave a very shaky laugh and downed the rest of his butterbeer in one.
"Breakfast!" said Sirius loudly and joyfully, jumping to his feet. "Where's that accursed house elf? Creature?
Creature!"
But Creature did not answer the summons.
"Oh, forget it then," muttered Sirius, counting the people in front of him. "So it's breakfast for, let's see, 7. Bacon and eggs, I think, and some tea and toast."
Harry hurried over to the stove to help. He did not want to intrude on the Weasley's happiness, and he dreaded the moment when Mrs. Weasley would ask him to recount his vision. However, he had barely taken plates from the dresser when Mrs. Weasley lifted them out of his hands and pulled him into a hug.
"I don't know what would have happened if it hadn't been for you, Harry," she said in a muffled voice. "They might not have found Arthur for hours, and then it would have been too late. But thanks to you, he's alive, and Dumbledore's been able to think up a good cover story for Arthur being where he was. You've no idea what trouble he would have been in otherwise. Look at poor Sturgis!"
Harry could hardly bear her gratitude, but fortunately she soon released him to turn to Sirius and thank him for looking after her children through the night. Sirius said he was very pleased to have been able to help, and hoped they would all stay with him as long as Mr. Weasley was in hospital.
"Oh, Sirius, I'm so grateful. They think he'll be there a little while, and it would be wonderful to be nearer. Of course, that might mean we're here for Christmas."
"The more the merrier,"
said Sirius, with such obvious sincerity that Mrs. Weasley beamed at him, threw on an apron, and began to help with breakfast.
"Sirius," Harry muttered, unable to stand it a moment longer, "can I have a quick word? Now?"
He walked into the dark pantry and Sirius followed. Without preamble, Harry told his godfather every detail of the vision he had had, including the fact that he himself had been the snake who had attacked Mr. Weasley. When he paused for breath, Sirius said, "Did you tell Dumbledore this?"
"Yes," said Harry impatiently, "but he didn't tell me what it meant. Well, he doesn't tell me anything any more.
"'I'm sure he would have told you if it was anything to worry about,' said Sirius steadily.
"'But that's not all,' said Harry, in a voice only a little above a whisper. "'Sirius, I think I'm going mad. "'Back in Dumbledore's office, just before we took the port key, "'for a couple of seconds there, I thought I was a snake. "'I felt like one. "'My scar really hurt when I was looking at Dumbledore. "'Sirius, I wanted to attack him.'
"'He could only see a sliver of Sirius's face. "'The rest was in darkness.
"'It must have been the aftermath of the vision, that's all,' said Sirius. "'You were still thinking of the dream, or whatever it was, and—'
"'It wasn't that,' said Harry, shaking his head. "'It was like something rose up inside me, like there's a snake inside me.'
"'You need to sleep,' said Sirius firmly. "'You're going to have breakfast, then go upstairs to bed, and after lunch you can go and see Arthur with the others. "'You're in shock, Harry. You're blaming yourself for something you only witnessed, and it's lucky you did witness it, or Arthur might have died. Just stop worrying.' He clapped Harry on the shoulder and left the pantry, leaving Harry standing alone in the dark. Everyone but Harry spent the rest of the morning sleeping. He went up to the bedroom he and Ron had shared over the last few weeks of summer, but while Ron crawled into bed and was asleep within minutes, Harry sat fully clothed, hunched against the cold metal bars of the bedstead, keeping himself deliberately uncomfortable. Determined not to fall into a doze, terrified that he might become the serpent again in his sleep, and wake to find that he had attacked Ron, or else slithered through the house after one of the others. When Ron woke up, Harry pretended to have enjoyed a refreshing nap too. Their trunks arrived from Hogwarts while they were eating lunch, so they could dress as muggles for the trip to St. Mungo's. Everybody except Harry was riotously happy and talkative as they changed out of their robes into jeans and sweatshirts. When Tonks and Mad-Eye turned up to escort them across London, they greeted them gleefully, laughing at the bowler hat Mad-Eye was wearing at an angle to conceal his magical eye, and assuring him, truthfully, that Tonks, whose hair was short and bright pink again, would attract far less attention on the underground. Tonks was very interested in Harry's vision of the attack on Mr. Weasley, something Harry was not remotely interested in discussing.
"'There isn't any seer blood in your family, is there?' she inquired curiously, as they sat side by side on a train rattling towards the heart of the city.
"'No,' said Harry, thinking of Professor Trelawney and feeling insulted.
"'No,' said Tonks musingly. "'Now, I suppose it's not really prophecy you're doing, is it? "'I mean, you're not seeing the future, you're seeing the present. "'It's odd, isn't it? Useful, though.'
"'Harry didn't answer. "'Fortunately, they got out at the next stop, "'a station in the very heart of London, "'and in the bustle of leaving the train, "'he was able to follow Fred and George "'to get between himself and Tonks, who was leading the way. "'They all followed her up the escalator.' Moody clunking along at the back of the group, his bowler tilted low and one gnarled hand stuck in between the buttons of his coat, clutching his wand. Harry thought he sensed the concealed eye staring hard at him. Trying to avoid any more questions about his dream, he asked Mad-Eye where St. Mungo's was hidden.
"'Not far from here,'
grunted Moody as they stepped out into the wintry air on a broad, store-lined street packed with Christmas shoppers. He pushed Harry a little ahead of him and stumped along just behind. Harry knew the eye was rolling in all directions under the tilted hat.
"'Wasn't easy to find a good location for a hospital. Nowhere in Diagon Alley was big enough, and we couldn't have it underground like the Ministry. Wouldn't be healthy. In the end, they managed to get hold of a building up here. Theory was, sick wizards can come and go and just blend in with the crowd.'
He seized Harry's shoulder to prevent them being separated by a gaggle of shoppers, plainly intent on nothing but making it into a nearby shop full of electrical gadgets.
"'Here we go,' said Moody, a moment later.
They had arrived outside a large, old-fashioned, red-brick department store called Purge and Douse Limited. The place had a shabby, miserable air.
The window displays consisted of a few chipped dummies with their wigs askew, standing at random and modelling fashions at least 10 years out of date. Large signs on all the dusty doors read, "Closed for refurbishment." Harry distinctly heard a large woman laden with plastic shopping bags say to her friend as they passed, "It's never open, that place."
"Right,"
said Tonks, beckoning them towards a window displaying nothing but a particularly ugly female dummy. Its false eyelashes were hanging off, and it was modelling a green nylon pinafore dress.
"Everybody ready?"
They nodded, clustering around her. Moody gave Harry another shove between the shoulder blades to urge him forward, and Tonks leaned close to the glass, looking up at the very ugly dummy, her breath steaming up the glass.
"Watch her,"
she said.
"We're here to see Arthur Weasley."
Harry thought how absurd it was for Tonks to expect the dummy to hear her talking so quietly through a sheet of glass, with buses rumbling along behind her and all the racket of a street full of shoppers. Then he reminded himself that dummies couldn't hear anyway. Next second, his mouth opened in shock as the dummy gave a tiny nod and beckoned with its jointed finger, and Tonks had seized Ginny and Mrs. Weasley by the elbows, stepped right through the glass, and vanished. Fred, George, and Ron stepped after them. Harry glanced around at the jostling crowd. Not one of them seemed to have a glance to spare for window displays as ugly as those of Purge and Douse Limited, nor did any of them seem to have noticed that six people had just melted into thin air in front of them.
"Come on,"
growled Moody, giving Harry yet another poke in the back, and together they stepped forward through what felt like a sheet of cool water, emerging quite warm and dry on the other side. There was no sign of the ugly dummy or the space where she had stood. They were in what seemed to be a crowded reception area, where rows of witches and wizards sat upon rickety wooden chairs, some looking perfectly normal and perusing out-of-date copies of Witch Weekly, others sporting gruesome disfigurements, such as elephant trunks or extra hands sticking out of their chests. The room was scarcely less quiet than the street outside, for many of the patients were making very peculiar noises. A sweaty-faced witch in the centre of the front row, who was fanning herself vigorously with a copy of the Daily Prophet, kept letting off a high-pitched whistle as steam came pouring out of her mouth. A grubby-looking warlock in the corner clanged like a bell every time he moved, and with each clang his head vibrated horribly so that he had to seize himself by the ears to hold it steady. Witches and wizards in lime-green robes were walking up and down the rows, asking questions and making notes on clipboards like umbrages. Harry noticed the emblem embroidered on their chests, a wand and bone crossed. "Are they doctors?" he asked Ron quietly. "Doctors?" said Ron, looking startled. "Those muggle nutters that cut people up. Nah, they're healers." "Over here," called Mrs. Weasley, above the renewed clanging of the warlock in the corner, and they followed her to the queue in front of a plump blonde witch seated at a desk marked Inquiries. The wall behind her was covered in notices and posters saying things like, "A clean cauldron keeps potions from becoming poisons," and "Antidotes are anti-don'ts, unless approved by a qualified healer." There was also a large portrait of a witch with long silver ringlets, which was labelled Dilys Derwent, St. Mungo's Healer, 1722-1741, Headmistress of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, 1741-1768. Dilys was eyeing the Weasley party as though counting them. When Harry caught her eye, she gave a tiny wink, walked sideways out of her portrait, and vanished. Meanwhile, at the front of the queue, a young wizard was performing an odd on-the-spot jig and trying, in between yelps of pain, to explain his predicament to the witch behind the desk. "It's these, ouch, shoes my brother gave me. Ow! They're eating my, ouch, feet. Look at them. There must be some kind of, ah, jinx on them, and I can't, ah, get them off." He hopped from one foot to the other as though dancing on hot coals.
"The shoes don't prevent you reading, do they?"
said the blonde witch, irritably pointing at a large sign to the left of her desk.
"You want spell damage, fourth floor, just like it says on the floor guide. Next!"
As the wizard hobbled and pranced sideways out of the way, the Weasley party moved forward a few steps, and Harry read the floor guide. Artifact accidents. Cauldron explosion, wand backfiring, broom crashes, etc. Ground floor. Creature-induced injuries. Bites, stings, burns, embedded spines, etc. First floor. Magical bugs. Contagious maladies, e.g. dragon pox, vanishing sickness, scrofungulus, etc. Second floor. Potion and plant poisoning, rashes, regurgitation, uncontrollable giggling, etc. Third floor. Spell damage. Unliftable jinxes, hexes, incorrectly applied charms, etc. Fourth floor. Visitor's tea room, hospital shop. Fifth floor. If you are unsure where to go, incapable of normal speech, or unable to remember why you are here, our welcome witch will be pleased to help. A very old, stooped wizard with a hearing trumpet had shuffled to the front of the queue now.
"I'm here to see Broderick Bode," he wheezed.
"Ward 49, but I'm afraid you're wasting your time," said the witch dismissively. "He's completely addled, you know. Still thinks he's a teapot. Next!"
A harassed-looking wizard was holding his small daughter tightly by the ankle while she flapped around his head using the immensely large, feathery wings that had sprouted right out through the back of her romper suit.
"Fourth floor," said the witch in a bored voice, without asking,
and the man disappeared through the double doors beside the desk, holding his daughter like an oddly shaped balloon.
"Next!"
Mrs. Weasley moved forward to the desk.
"Hello," she said. "My husband, Arthur Weasley, was supposed to be moved to a different ward this morning. Could you tell us—"
"Arthur Weasley," said the witch, running her finger down a long list in front of her. "Yes, first floor, second door on the right, Di Llewellyn ward."
"Thank you," said Mrs. Weasley. "Come on, you lot!"
They followed her through the double doors and along the narrow corridor beyond, which was lined with more portraits of famous healers, and lit by crystal bubbles full of candles that floated up on the ceiling, looking like giant soap suds. More witches and wizards in lime-green robes walked in and out of the doors they passed. A foul-smelling yellow gas wafted into the passageway as they passed one door, and every now and then they heard distant wailing. They climbed a flight of stairs and entered the creature-induced injuries corridor, where the second door on the right bore the words, "Dangerous Di Llewellyn Ward, Serious Bites." Underneath this was a card in a brass holder on which had been handwritten, "Healer in Charge, Hippocrates Smethick, Trainee Healer, Augustus Pye."
"We'll wait outside, Molly," Tonks said. "Arthur won't want too many visitors at once. It ought to be just the family first."
Mad-Eye growled his approval of this idea and set himself with his back against the corridor wall, his magical eyes spinning in all directions. Harry drew back too, but Mrs. Weasley reached out a hand and pushed him through the door, saying,
"Don't be silly, Harry. Arthur wants to thank you."
The ward was small and rather dingy, as the only window was narrow and set high in the wall facing the door. Most of the light came from more shining crystal bubbles clustered in the middle of the ceiling. The walls were of panelled oak, and there was a portrait of a rather vicious-looking wizard on the wall, captioned, "Urquhart Rackharrow, 1612 to 1697, inventor of the entrail expelling curse." There were only three patients. Mr. Weasley was occupying the bed at the far end of the ward, beside the tiny window. Harry was pleased and relieved to see that he was propped up on several pillows and reading the Daily Prophet by the solitary ray of sunlight falling onto his bed. He looked up as they walked towards him, and seeing who it was, beamed.
"Hello!" he called, throwing the prophet aside.
"Bill just left, Molly, and had to get back to work, but he says he'll drop in on you later."
"How are you, Arthur?"
asked Mrs. Weasley, bending down to kiss his cheek and looking anxiously into his face.
"'You're still looking a bit peaky.'
"'I feel absolutely fine,' said Mr. Weasley brightly, "'holding out his good arm to give Ginny a hug. "'If they could only take the bandages off, I'd be fit to go home.'
"'Why can't they take them off, Dad?' asked Fred.
"'Well, I start bleeding like mad every time they try,' said Mr. Weasley cheerfully, "'reaching across for his wand, which lay on his bedside cabinet, "'and waving it so that six extra chairs appeared at his bedside to seat them all.
"'It seems there was some rather unusual kind of poison in that snake's fangs that keeps wounds open. "'They're sure they'll find an antidote, though. "'They say they've had much worse cases than mine, "'and in the meantime I just have to keep taking a blood-replenishing potion every hour.' "'But that fellow over there,' he said, dropping his voice and nodding towards the bed opposite, in which a man lay looking green and sickly and staring at the ceiling.
"'Bitten by a werewolf, poor chap. No cure at all.'
"'A werewolf?' whispered Mrs. Weasley, looking alarmed. "'Is he safe in a public ward? Shouldn't he be in a private room?'
"'It's 2 weeks till full moon,' Mr. Weasley reminded her quietly. "'They've been talking to him this morning, the healers, you know, "'trying to persuade him he'll be able to lead an almost normal life. "'I said to him, didn't mention names, of course, "'but I said I knew a werewolf personally, very nice man, "'who finds the condition quite easy to manage.'
"'What did he say?' asked George.
"'Said he'd give me another bite if I didn't shut up,' said Mr. Weasley sadly. "'And that woman over there,'
he indicated the only other occupied bed, "'which was right beside the door,
"'won't tell the healers what bit her, "'which makes us all think it must have been something "'she was handling illegally. "'Whatever it was took a real chunk out of her leg. "'Very nasty smell when they take off the dressings.'
"'So you're going to tell us what happened, Dad?' "'asked Fred, pulling his chair closer to the bed.
"'Well, you already know, don't you?'
"'said Mr. Weasley with a significant smile at Harry.
"'It's very simple. "'I'd had a very long day, dozed off.' "'Got sneaked up on and bitten.'
"'Is it in the Prophet you being attacked?' asked Fred, indicating the newspaper Mr. Weasley had cast aside.
"'No, of course not,' said Mr. Weasley with a slightly bitter smile. "'The ministry wouldn't want everyone to know a dirty great serpent got
Arthur,' Mrs. Weasley warned him.
"'Got, me,' Mr. Weasley said hastily,
though Harry was quite sure that was not what he had meant to say.
"'So where were you when it happened, Dad?' asked George. "'That's my business,' said Mr. Weasley, though with a small smile.
He snatched up the Daily Prophet, shook it open again, and said, "'I was just reading about Willie Widdershin's arrest when you arrived.
You know, Willie turned out to be behind those regurgitating toilets back in the summer. One of his jinxes backfired, the toilet exploded, and they found him lying unconscious in the wreckage, covered from head to foot in—'
"'When you say you were on duty,' Fred interrupted in a low voice, "'what were you doing?'
"'You heard your father,' whispered Mrs. Weasley. "'We are not discussing this here. "'Go on about Willie Widdershins, Arthur.' "'Well, don't ask me how, but he actually got off the toilet charge,' said Mr. Weasley grimly. "'I can only suppose gold changed hands.'
"'You were guarding it, weren't you?' said George quietly.
"'The weapon—' "'The thing you know who's after.' "'George, be quiet!' snapped Mrs. Weasley. "'Anyway,' said Mr. Weasley in a raised voice, "'this time Willie's been caught selling biting doorknobs to muggles, "'and I don't think he'll be able to worm his way out of it, "'because, according to this article, two muggles have lost fingers "'and are now in St. Mungo's for emergency bone regrowth and memory modification. "'Just think of it!' "'Muggles in St. Mungo's. "'I wonder which ward they're in.'
"'And he looked eagerly around "'as though hoping to see a signpost.
"'Didn't you say you know who's got a snake, Harry?' "'asked Fred, looking at his father for a reaction.
"'A massive one. "'You saw it the night he returned, didn't you?'
"'That's enough,' said Mrs. Weasley crossly. "'Mad-Eye and Tonks are outside, Arthur. "'They want to come and see you. "'And you lot can wait outside.'
she added to her children and Harry.
"'You can come and say goodbye afterwards. Go on!'
They trooped back into the corridor. Mad-Eye and Tonks went in and closed the door of the ward behind them. Fred raised his eyebrows.
"'Fine,' he said coolly, rummaging in his pockets. "'Be like that. Don't tell us anything.'
"Looking for these?" said George, holding out what looked like a tangle of flesh-coloured string. "You read my mind," said Fred, grinning. "Let's see if St. Mungo's puts imperturbable charms on its ward doors, shall we?" He and George disentangled the string and separated 5 extendable ears from each other. Fred and George handed them around. Harry hesitated to take one.
"Go on, Harry, take it. You saved Dad's life. If anyone's got the right to eavesdrop on him, it's you."
Grinning in spite of himself, Harry took the end of the string and inserted it into his ear, as the twins had done.
"Okay, go,"
Fred whispered. The flesh-coloured strings wriggled like long, skinny worms and snaked under the door. At first, Harry could hear nothing. Then he jumped as he heard Tonks whispering as clearly as though she were standing right beside him.
"They searched the whole area, but couldn't find the snake anywhere. It just seems to have vanished after it attacked you, Arthur. But you know who can't have expected a snake to get in, can he?"
"I reckon he's sent it as a lookout," growled Moody. "'Cause he's not had any luck so far, has he? No, I reckon he's trying to get a clearer picture of what he's facing, and if Arthur hadn't been there, the beast would have had a lot more time to look around. So, Potter says he saw it all happen."
"Yes," said Mrs. Weasley. She sounded rather uneasy. "You know, Dumbledore seems almost to have been waiting for Harry to see something like this."
"Yeah, well," said Moody, "there's something funny about the Potter kid. We all know that."
"Dumbledore seemed worried about Harry when I spoke to him this morning," whispered Mrs. Weasley.
"Course he's worried," growled Moody. "The boy's seeing things from inside you-know-who's snake. Obviously Potter doesn't realise what that means, but if you-know-who's possessing him..."
Harry pulled the extendable ear out of his own, his heart hammering very fast and heat rushing up his face. He looked around at the others. They were all staring at him, the strings still trailing from their ears, looking suddenly fearful. Chapter 23. Christmas on the Closed Ward. Was this why Dumbledore would no longer meet Harry's eyes? Did he expect to see Voldemort staring out of them, afraid, perhaps, that their vivid green might turn suddenly to scarlet, with cat-like slits for pupils? Harry remembered how the snake-like face of Voldemort had once forced itself out of the back of Professor Quirrell's head, and ran his hand over the back of his own, wondering what it would feel like if Voldemort burst out of his skull. He felt dirty, contaminated, as though he were carrying some deadly germ, unworthy to sit on the underground train back from the hospital with innocent, clean people whose minds and bodies were free of the taint of Voldemort. He had not merely seen the snake. He had been the snake. He knew it now. A truly terrible thought then occurred to him, a memory bobbing to the surface of his mind. One that made his insides writhe and squirm like serpents. What's he after, apart from followers? Stuff he can only get by stealth, like a weapon, something he didn't have last time. I'm the weapon, Harry thought, and it was as though poison were pumping through his veins, chilling him, bringing him out in a sweat as he swayed with the train through the dark tunnel. I'm the one Voldemort's trying to use. That's why they've got guards around me everywhere I go. It's not for my protection. It's for other people's. Only it's not working. They can't have someone on me all the time at Hogwarts. I did attack Mr. Weasley last night. It was me. Voldemort made me do it. And he could be inside me, listening to my thoughts, right now. Are you all right, Harry dear? Whispered Mrs. Weasley, leaning across Ginny to speak to him as the train rattled along through its dark tunnel. You don't look very well. Are you feeling sick? They were all watching him. He shook his head violently and stared up at an advertisement for home insurance. Harry, dear, are you sure you're all right? said Mrs. Weasley in a worried voice, as they walked around the unkempt patch of grass in the middle of Grim Old Place.
"You look ever so pale. Are you sure you slept this morning? You go upstairs to bed right now, and you can have a couple of hours of sleep before dinner, all right?"
He nodded. Here was a ready-made excuse not to talk to any of the others, which was precisely what he wanted. So when she opened the front door, he hurried straight past the Troll's Leg umbrella stand, up the stairs, and into his and Ron's bedroom. Here he began to pace up and down, past the two beds and Phineas Nigellus's empty picture frame, his brain teeming and seething with questions and ever more dreadful ideas. How had he become a snake? Perhaps he was an animagus. No, he couldn't be. He would know. Perhaps Voldemort was an animagus. Yes, thought Harry, that would fit. He would turn into a snake, of course. And when he's possessing me, then we both transform. That still doesn't explain how I got to London and back to my bed in the space of about 5 minutes. But then Voldemort's about the most powerful wizard in the world, apart from Dumbledore. It's probably no problem at all to him to transport people like that. And then, with a terrible stab of panic, he thought, "But this is insane. If Voldemort's possessing me, I'm giving him a clear view into the headquarters of the Order of the Phoenix right now. He'll know who's in the Order and where Sirius is. And I've heard loads of stuff I shouldn't have, everything Sirius told me the first night I was here." There was only one thing for it. He would have to leave Grim Old Place straight away. He would spend Christmas at Hogwarts without the others, which would keep them safe over the holidays at least. But no, that wouldn't do. There were still plenty of people at Hogwarts to maim and injure. What if it was Seamus, Dean, or Neville next time? He stopped his pacing and stood staring at Phineas Nigellus's empty frame. A leaden sensation was settling in the pit of his stomach. He had no alternative. He was going to have to return to Privet Drive, cut himself off from other wizards entirely. Well, if he had to do it, he thought, there was no point hanging around. Trying with all his might not to think how the Dursleys were going to react when they found him on their doorstep 6 months earlier than they had expected, he strode over to his trunk, slammed the lid shut, and locked it, then glanced around automatically for Hedwig, before remembering that she was still at Hogwarts. Well, her cage would be one less thing to carry. He seized one end of his trunk, and had dragged it halfway towards the door, when a snide voice said, "Running away, are we?" He looked around. Phineas Nigellus had appeared on the canvas of his portrait and was leaning against the frame, watching Harry with an amused expression on his face. "Not running away, no," said Harry shortly, dragging his trunk a few more feet across the room. "I thought," said Phineas Nigellus, stroking his pointed beard, "that to belong in Gryffindor House you were supposed to be brave. Looks to me as though you would have been better off in my own house. We Slytherins are brave, yes, but not stupid. For instance, given the choice, we will always choose to save our own necks." "It's not my own neck I'm saving," said Harry tersely, tugging the trunk over a patch of particularly uneven, moth-eaten carpet right in front of the door. "Oh, I see," said Phineas Nigellus, still stroking his beard. "This is no cowardly flight. You are being noble." Harry ignored him. His hand was on the doorknob when Phineas Nigellus said lazily, "I have a message for you from Albus Dumbledore." Harry span round. "What is it?" "Stay where you are." "I haven't moved," said Harry, his hand still upon the doorknob. "So what's the message?" "I've just given it to you, dolt," said Phineas Nigellus smoothly. "Dumbledore says, stay where you are." "Why?" said Harry eagerly, dropping the end of his trunk. "Why does he want me to stay? What else did he say?" "Nothing whatsoever," said Phineas Nigellus, raising a thin black eyebrow as though he found Harry impertinent. Harry's temper rose to the surface like a snake rearing from long grass.
He was exhausted. He was confused beyond measure. He had experienced terror, relief, then terror again in the last 12 hours, and still Dumbledore did not want to talk to him. "So that's it, is it?" he said loudly. "Stay where you are? That's all anyone could tell me after I got attacked by those Dementors, too. Just stay put while the grown-ups sort it out, Harry. We won't bother telling you anything, though, because your tiny little brain might not be able to cope with it."
"You know,"
said Phineas Nigellus even more loudly than Harry, "this is precisely why I loathed being a teacher. Young people are so infernally convinced that they are absolutely right about everything. Has it not occurred to you, my poor puffed-up popinjay, that there might be an excellent reason why the headmaster of Hogwarts is not confiding every tiny detail of his plans to you? Have you never paused, while feeling hard done by, to note that following Dumbledore's orders has never yet led you into harm? No. No, like all young people, you're quite sure that you alone feel and think, you alone recognise danger, you alone are the only one clever enough to realise what the Dark Lord may be planning."
"He is planning something to do with me, then," said Harry swiftly.
"Did I say that?" said Phineas Nigellus, idly examining his silk gloves. "Now, if you will excuse me, I have better things to do than listen to adolescent agonizing. Good day to you." And he strolled to the edge of his frame and out of sight.
"Fine! Go, then!" Harry bellowed at the empty frame. "And tell Dumbledore thanks for nothing!"
The empty canvas remained silent. Fuming, Harry dragged his trunk back to the foot of his bed, then threw himself face down on the moth-eaten covers, his eyes shut, his body heavy and aching. He felt as though he had journeyed for miles and miles. It seemed impossible that less than 24 hours ago Cho Chang had been approaching him under the mistletoe. He was so tired. He was scared to sleep, yet he did not know how long he could fight it. Dumbledore had told him to stay. That must mean he was allowed to sleep. But he was scared. What if it happened again? He was sinking into shadows. It was as though a film in his head had been waiting to start. He was walking down a deserted corridor towards a plain black door, past rough stone walls, torches, and an open doorway onto a flight of stone steps leading downstairs on the left. He reached the black door, but could not open it. He stood gazing at it, desperate for entry. Something he wanted with all his heart lay beyond, a prize beyond his dreams. If only his scar would stop prickling, then he would be able to think more clearly.
"Harry!"
said Ron's voice from far, far away.
"Mum says dinner's ready, but she'll save you something if you want to stay in bed."
Harry opened his eyes, but Ron had already left the room. "He doesn't want to be on his own with me," Harry thought. "Not after what he heard Moody say." He supposed none of them would want him there any more, now that they knew what was inside him. He would not go down to dinner. He would not inflict his company on them. He turned over onto his other side and, after a while, dropped back off to sleep. He woke much later, in the early hours of the morning, his insides aching with hunger and Ron snoring in the next bed. Squinting around the room, he saw the dark outline of Phineas Nigellus standing again in his portrait, and it occurred to Harry that Dumbledore had probably sent Phineas Nigellus to watch over him in case he attacked somebody else. The feeling of being unclean intensified. He half wished he had not obeyed Dumbledore. If this was how life was going to be for him in Grim Old Place from now on, maybe he would be better off in Privet Drive after all. Everybody else spent the following morning putting up Christmas decorations. Harry could not remember Sirius ever being in such a good mood.
he was actually singing carols, apparently delighted that he was to have company over Christmas. Harry could hear his voice echoing up through the floor in the cold drawing-room where he was sitting alone, watching the sky growing whiter outside the windows, threatening snow, all the time feeling a savage pleasure that he was giving the others the opportunity to keep talking about him, as they were bound to be doing. When he heard Mrs. Weasley calling his name softly up the stairs around lunchtime, he retreated further upstairs and ignored her. Around 6 o'clock in the evening, the doorbell rang, and Mrs. Black started screaming again. Assuming that Mundungus or some other order member had come to call, Harry merely settled himself more comfortably against the wall of Buckbeak's room where he was hiding, trying to ignore how hungry he felt as he fed dead rats to the hippogriff. It came as a slight shock when somebody hammered hard on the door a few minutes later.
"I know you're in there," said Hermione's voice. "Will you please come out? I want to talk to you."
"What are you doing here?" Harry asked her, pulling open the door as Buckbeak resumed his scratching at the straw-strewn floor for any fragments of rat he may have dropped.
"I thought you were skiing with your mum and dad." "Well, to tell the truth, skiing's not really my thing," said Hermione, "so I've come here for Christmas."
There was snow in her hair, and her face was pink with cold. "But don't tell Ron. I told him skiing's really good because he kept laughing so much. Mum and Dad are a bit disappointed, but I've told them that everyone who is serious about the exams is staying at Hogwarts to study. They want me to do well. They'll understand." "Anyway," she said briskly, "let's go to your bedroom. Ron's mum has lit a fire in there, and she sent up sandwiches." Harry followed her back to the second floor. When he entered the bedroom, he was rather surprised to see both Ron and Ginny waiting for them, sitting on Ron's bed.
"I came on the night bus," said Hermione airily, pulling off her jacket before Harry had time to speak. "Dumbledore told me what had happened first thing this morning, but I had to wait for term to end officially before setting off. Umbridge is already livid that you lot disappeared right under her nose, even though Dumbledore told her Mr. Weasley was in St. Mungo's and had given you all permission to visit. So..."
She sat down next to Ginny, and the two girls and Ron all looked up at Harry.
"How are you feeling?" asked Hermione.
"Fine," said Harry stiffly.
"Oh, don't lie, Harry," she said impatiently. "Ron and Ginny say you've been hiding from everyone since you got back from St. Mungo's."
"They do they?" said Harry, glaring at Ron and Ginny. Ron looked down at his feet, but Ginny seemed quite unabashed.
"Well, you have," she said. "And you won't look at any of us."
"It's you lot who won't look at me," said Harry angrily.
"Maybe you're taking it in turns to look and keep missing each other," suggested Hermione, the corners of her mouth twitching.
"Very funny," snapped Harry, turning away.
"Oh, stop feeling all misunderstood," said Hermione sharply. "Look, the others have told me what you overheard last night on the extendable ears."
"Yeah," growled Harry, his hands deep in his pockets as he watched the snow now falling thickly outside. "All been talking about me, have you? Well, I'm getting used to it."
"We wanted to talk to you, Harry," said Ginny, "but as you've been hiding ever since we got back..."
"I didn't want anyone to talk to me," said Harry, who was feeling more and more nettled.
"Well, that was a bit stupid of you," said Ginny angrily, "seeing as you don't know anyone but me who's been possessed by you-know-who, and I can tell you how it feels."
Harry remained quite still as the impact of these words hit him. Then he turned on the spot to face her.
"I forgot," he said.
"Lucky you," said Ginny coolly. "I'm sorry," Harry said, and he meant it. So do you think I'm being possessed, then?"
"Well, can you remember everything you've been doing?" Ginny asked. "Are there big blank periods where you don't know what you've been up to?"
Harry racked his brains.
"No,"
he said.
"Then you know who hasn't ever possessed you," said Ginny simply. "When he did it to me, I couldn't remember what I'd been doing for hours at a time. I'd find myself somewhere and not know how I got there."
Harry hardly dared believe her, yet his heart was lightening almost in spite of himself.
"That dream I had about your dad and the snake, though."
"Harry, you've had these dreams before," Hermione said.
"You had flashes of what Voldemort was up to last year."
"This was different," said Harry, shaking his head.
"I was inside that snake. It was like I was the snake. What if Voldemort somehow transported me to London?"
"One day," said Hermione, sounding thoroughly exasperated, "you'll read Hogwarts: A History, and perhaps it will remind you that you can't apparate or disapparate inside Hogwarts. Even Voldemort couldn't just make you fly out of your dormitory, Harry."
"You didn't leave your bed, mate," said Ron. "I saw you thrashing around in your sleep for at least a minute before we could wake you up."
Harry started pacing up and down the room again, thinking. What they were all saying was not only comforting, it made sense. Without really thinking, he took a sandwich from the plate on the bed and crammed it hungrily into his mouth. "I'm not the weapon after all," thought Harry. His heart swelled with happiness and relief, and he felt like joining in as they heard Sirius tramping past their door towards Buckbeak's room, singing "God Rest Ye Merry Hippogriffs" at the top of his voice. How could he have dreamed of returning to Privet Drive for Christmas? Sirius's delight at having the house full again, and especially at having Harry back, was infectious. He was no longer their sullen host of the summer. Now he seemed determined that everyone should enjoy themselves as much, if not more, than they would have done at Hogwarts, and he worked tirelessly in the run-up to Christmas Day, cleaning and decorating with their help, so that by the time they all went to bed on Christmas Eve, the house was barely recognizable. The tarnished chandeliers were no longer hung with cobwebs, but with garlands of holly and gold and silver streamers. Magical snow glittered in heaps over the threadbare carpets. A great Christmas tree, obtained by Mundungus and decorated with live fairies, blocked Sirius's family tree from view. And even the stuffed elf heads on the hall wall wore Father Christmas hats and beards. Harry awoke on Christmas morning to find a stack of presents at the foot of his bed, and Ron already halfway through opening his own, rather larger, pile.
"Good haul this year," he informed Harry through a cloud of paper. "Thanks for the broom compass. It's excellent.
Beats Hermione's. She's got me a homework planner." Harry sorted through his presents and found one with Hermione's handwriting on it. She had given him, too, a book that resembled a diary, except that every time he opened a page, it said aloud things like, "Do it today, or later you'll pay." Sirius and Lupin had given Harry a set of excellent books entitled Practical Defensive Magic and Its Use Against the Dark Arts, which had superb, moving-colour illustrations of all the counter-jinxes and hexes it described. Harry flicked through the first volume eagerly. He could see it was going to be highly useful in his plans for the DA. Hagrid had sent a furry brown wallet that had fangs, which were presumably supposed to be an anti-theft device, but unfortunately prevented Harry putting any money in without getting his fingers ripped off. Tonks's present was a small, working model of a firebolt, which Harry watched fly around the room, wishing he still had his full-size version. Ron had given him an enormous box of every-flavour beans. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley, the usual hand-knitted jumper and some mince pies, and Dobby, a truly dreadful painting that Harry suspected had been done by the elf himself. He had just turned it upside down to see whether it looked better that way, when, with a loud crack, Fred and George apparated at the foot of his bed.
"Merry Christmas," said George.
"Don't go downstairs for a bit."
"Why not?" said Ron.
"Mum's crying again," said Fred heavily. "Percy sent back his Christmas jumper." "Without a note," added George.
"Hasn't asked how Dad is, or visited him, or anything."
"We tried to comfort her," said Fred, moving around the bed to look at Harry's portrait. "Told her Percy's nothing more than a humongous pile of rat droppings."
"Didn't work," said George, helping himself to a chocolate frog.
So Lupin took over. Best let him cheer her up before we go down for breakfast, I reckon.
"What's that supposed to be, anyway?"
asked Fred, squinting at Dobby's painting. "Looks like a gibbon with two black eyes."
"It's Harry," said George, pointing at the back of the picture. "Says so on the back."
"Good likeness," said Fred, grinning. Harry threw his new homework diary at him. It hit the wall opposite and fell to the floor, where it said happily, "If you've dotted the I's and crossed the T's, then you may do whatever you please." They got up and dressed. They could hear the various inhabitants of the house calling "Merry Christmas!" to one another. On their way downstairs, they met Hermione.
"Thanks for the book, Harry," she said happily. "I've been wanting that new theory of numerology for ages, and that perfume's really unusual, Ron."
"No problem," said Ron. "Who's that for, anyway?" he added, nodding at the neatly wrapped present she was carrying.
"Creature,"
said Hermione brightly.
"It had better not be clothes," Ron warned her. "You know what Sirius said. Creature knows too much. We can't set him free."
"It isn't clothes," said Hermione.
"Although if I had my way, I'd certainly give him something to wear other than that filthy old rag.
No, it's a patchwork quilt. I thought it would brighten up his bedroom."
"What bedroom?"
said Harry, dropping his voice to a whisper as they were passing the portrait of Sirius's mother.
"Well, Sirius says it's not so much a bedroom, more a kind of den," said Hermione. "Apparently he sleeps under the boiler in that cupboard off the kitchen."
Mrs. Weasley was the only person in the basement when they arrived there. She was standing at the stove and sounded as though she had a bad head cold as she wished them Merry Christmas, and they all averted their eyes.
"So is this creature's bedroom?" said Ron, strolling over to a dingy door in the corner opposite the pantry.
Harry had never seen it open.
"Yes,"
said Hermione, now sounding a little nervous.
"I think we'd better knock."
Ron rapped on the door with his knuckles, but there was no reply. "He must be sneaking around upstairs," he said, and without further ado pulled open the door.
"Ugh!"
Harry peered inside. Most of the cupboard was taken up with a very large and old-fashioned boiler. But in the foot of space underneath the pipes, Creature had made himself something that looked like a nest. A jumble of assorted rags and smelly old blankets were piled on the floor, and the small dent in the middle of it showed where Creature curled up to sleep every night. Here and there among the material were stale bread crusts and mouldy old bits of cheese. In a far corner glinted small objects and coins that Harry guessed Creature had saved, magpie-like, from Sirius's purge of the house. And he had also managed to retrieve the silver-framed family photographs that Sirius had thrown away over the summer. Their glass might be shattered, but still the little black-and-white people inside them peered up at him haughtily, including, he felt a little jolt in his stomach, the dark, heavy-lidded woman whose trial he had witnessed in Dumbledore's pensieve, Bellatrix Lestrange. By the looks of it, hers was Creature's favourite photograph. He had placed it to the fore of all the others and had mended the glass clumsily with spellotape.
"I think I'll just leave his present here,"
said Hermione, laying the package neatly in the middle of the depression in the rags and blankets and closing the door quietly.
"He'll find it later. That'll be fine."
"Come to think of it," said Sirius, emerging from the pantry carrying a large turkey as they closed the cupboard door, "has anyone actually seen Creature lately?"
"I haven't seen him since the night we came back here," said Harry. "You were ordering him out of the kitchen."
"Yeah," said Sirius, frowning. "You know, I think that's the last time I saw him, too. He must be hiding upstairs somewhere."
"He couldn't have left, could he?" said Harry. "I mean, when you said out, maybe he thought you meant get out of the house."
"No, no. House elves can't leave unless they're given clothes. They're tied to their family's house," said Sirius.
"They can leave the house if they really want to," Harry contradicted him. "Dobby did. He left the Malfoys to give me warnings 2 years ago. He had to punish himself afterwards, but he still managed it."
Sirius looked slightly disconcerted for a moment, then said,
"I'll look for him later.
I expect I'll find him upstairs, crying his eyes out over my mother's old bloomers or something. Of course, he might have crawled into the airing cupboard and died, but I mustn't get my hopes up. Fred, George and Ron laughed. Hermione, however, looked reproachful. Once they had eaten their Christmas lunch, the Weasleys, Harry and Hermione, were planning to pay Mr. Weasley another visit, escorted by Mad-Eye and Lupin. Mundungus turned up in time for Christmas pudding and trifle, having managed to borrow a car for the occasion, as the Underground did not run on Christmas Day. The car, which Harry doubted very much had been taken with the consent of its owner, had been enlarged with a spell, like the Weasleys' old Ford Anglia had once been. Although normally proportioned outside, 10 people, with Mundungus driving, were able to fit into it quite comfortably. Mrs. Weasley hesitated before getting inside. Harry knew her disapproval of Mundungus was battling with her dislike of travelling without magic. But finally the cold outside and her children's pleading triumphed, and she settled herself into the back seat between Fred and Bill with good grace. The journey to St. Mungo's was quite quick, as there was very little traffic on the roads. A small trickle of witches and wizards was creeping furtively up the otherwise deserted street to visit the hospital. Harry and the others got out of the car, and Mundungus drove off around the corner to wait for them. They strolled casually towards the window where the dummy in green nylon stood, then, one by one, stepped through the glass. The reception area looked pleasantly festive. The crystal orbs that illuminated St. Mungo's had been coloured red and gold to become gigantic, glowing Christmas baubles. Holly hung around every doorway, and shining white Christmas trees covered in magical snow and icicles glittered in every corner, each one topped with a gleaming gold star. It was less crowded than the last time they had been there, although halfway across the room, Harry found himself shunted aside by a witch with a satsuma jammed up her left nostril.
"Family argument, eh?"
smirked the blonde witch behind the desk.
"You're the third I've seen today. Spell damage, fourth floor."
They found Mr. Weasley propped up in bed, with the remains of his turkey dinner on a tray on his lap and a rather sheepish expression on his face.
"Everything all right, Arthur?"
asked Mrs. Weasley, after they had all greeted Mr. Weasley and handed over their presents.
"Fine, fine,"
said Mr. Weasley, a little too heartily.
"You, haven't seen Healer Smithick, have you?"
"No," said Mrs. Weasley suspiciously.
"Why?"
"Nothing, nothing," said Mr. Weasley airily, starting to unwrap his pile of gifts.
"Well, everyone had a good day. What did you all get for Christmas?" "Oh, Harry, this is absolutely wonderful,"
for he had just opened Harry's gift of fuse wire and screwdrivers. Mrs. Weasley did not seem entirely satisfied with Mr. Weasley's answer. As her husband leaned over to shake Harry's hand, she peered at the bandaging under his nightshirt.
"Arthur," she said with a snap in her voice like a mousetrap, "you've had your bandages changed. Why have you had your bandages changed a day early, Arthur? They told me they wouldn't need doing until tomorrow."
"What?" said Mr. Weasley, looking rather frightened and pulling the bedcovers higher up his chest.
"No, no, it's nothing.
He seemed to deflate under Mrs. Weasley's piercing gaze.
"Well, now, don't get upset, Molly, but Augustus Pye had an idea. He's the trainee healer, you know, lovely young chap, and very interested in, complementary medicine. I mean, some of these old muggle remedies. Well, they're called stitches, Molly, and they work very well on muggle wounds."
Mrs. Weasley let out an ominous noise, somewhere between a shriek and a snarl. Lupin strolled away from the bed and over to the werewolf, who had no visitors and was looking rather wistfully at the crowd around Mr. Weasley. Bill muttered something about getting himself a cup of tea, and Fred and George leapt up to accompany him, grinning.
"Do you mean to tell me?"
said Mrs. Weasley, her voice growing louder with every word, and apparently unaware that her fellow visitors were scurrying for cover,
"that you have been messing about with muggle remedies?"
"Not messing about, Molly dear," said Mr. Weasley imploringly. "It was just
Just something Pye and I thought we'd try. Only, most unfortunately, well, with these particular kinds of wounds, it doesn't seem to work as well as we'd hoped.
Meaning?
Well, I don't know whether you know what stitches are.
It sounds as though you've been trying to sew your skin back together, said Mrs. Weasley, with a snort of mirthless laughter. But even you, Arthur, wouldn't be that stupid.
I fancy a cup of tea too, said Harry, jumping to his feet.
Hermione, Ron and Ginny almost sprinted to the door with him. As it swung closed behind them, they heard Mrs. Weasley shriek,
What do you mean that's the general idea?
Typical Dad, said Ginny, shaking her head as they set off up the corridor. Stitches? I ask you.
Well, you know, they do work well on non-magical wounds, said Hermione fairly. I suppose something in that snake's venom dissolves them or something. I wonder where the tea room is.
Fifth floor, said Harry, remembering the sign over the Welcome Witch's desk. They walked along the corridor, through a set of double doors, and found a rickety staircase lined with more portraits of brutal-looking healers. As they climbed it, the various healers called out to them, diagnosing odd complaints and suggesting horrible remedies. Ron was seriously affronted when a medieval wizard called out that he clearly had a bad case of spattergroit.
"And what's that supposed to be?"
he asked angrily, as the healer pursued him through six more portraits, shoving the occupants out of the way.
"'Tis a most grievous affliction of the skin, young master, that will leave you pockmarked and more gruesome even than you are now.
Watch who you're calling gruesome,"
said Ron, his ears turning red.
"The only remedy is to take the liver of a toad, bind it tight about your throat, stand naked at the full moon in a barrel of eel's eyes.
I have not got spattergroit.
But the unsightly blemishes upon your visage, young master.
They're freckles, said Ron furiously. Now get back in your own picture and leave me alone.
He rounded on the others, who were all keeping determinedly straight faces.
What floor's this?
I think it's the fifth, said Hermione.
No, it's the fourth, said Harry. One more. But as he stepped onto the landing, he came to an abrupt halt. Staring at the small window set into the double doors that marked the start of a corridor signposted Spell Damage. A man was peering out at them all with his nose pressed against the glass. He had wavy blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and a broad, vacant smile that revealed dazzlingly white teeth.
Blimey, said Ron, also staring at the man.
Oh, my goodness, said Hermione suddenly, sounding breathless. Professor Lockhart!
Their ex-Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher pushed open the doors and moved towards them, wearing a long lilac dressing gown.
Well, hello there, he said. I expect you'd like my autograph, would you?
Hasn't changed much, has he? Harry muttered to Ginny, who grinned.
How are you, Professor? Said Ron, sounding slightly guilty. It had been Ron's malfunctioning wand that had damaged Professor Lockhart's memory so badly that he had landed in St. Mungo's in the first place.
Though as Lockhart had been attempting to permanently wipe Harry and Ron's memories at the time, Harry's sympathy was limited.
"I'm very well indeed, thank you," said Lockhart exuberantly, pulling a rather battered peacock feather quill from his pocket. "Now, how many autographs would you like? I can do joined-up writing now, you know."
"We don't want any at the moment, thanks," said Ron, raising his eyebrows at Harry, who asked, "Professor, should you be wandering around the corridors? Shouldn't you be in a ward?" The smile faded slowly from Lockhart's face. For a few moments he gazed intently at Harry. Then he said, "Haven't we met?"
"Yeah, we have," said Harry. "You used to teach us at Hogwarts, remember?"
"Teach?" repeated Lockhart, looking faintly unsettled.
"Me? Did I?"
And then the smile reappeared upon his face so suddenly it was rather alarming.
Taught you everything you know, I expect, did I? Well, how about those autographs, then? Shall we say a round dozen? You can give them to all your little friends, then, and nobody will be left out.
But just then a head poked out of a door at the far end of the corridor, and a voice called,
"Gilderoy, you naughty boy, where have you wandered off to?"
A motherly-looking healer, wearing a tinsel wreath in her hair, came bustling up the corridor, smiling warmly at Harry and the others.
"Oh, Gilderoy, you've got visitors. How lovely! And on Christmas Day, too. Do you know, he never gets visitors, poor lamb, and I can't think why. He's such a sweetie, aren't you?"
"We're doing autographs," Gilderoy told the healer with another glittering smile. "They want loads of them. Won't take no for an answer. I just hope we've got enough photographs."
"Listen to him,"
said the healer, taking Lockhart's arm and beaming fondly at him as though he were a precocious 2-year-old.
"He was rather well known a few years ago. We very much hope that this liking for giving autographs is a sign that his memory might be starting to come back. Will you step this way? He's in a closed ward, you know. He must have slipped out while I was bringing in the Christmas presents. The door's usually kept locked. Not that he's dangerous, but," she lowered her voice to a whisper, "he's a bit of a danger to himself, bless him. Doesn't know who he is, you see. Wanders off and can't remember how to get back. It is nice of you to come and see him."
Said Ron, gesturing uselessly at the floor above. "Actually, we were just,
But the healer was smiling expectantly at them, and Ron's feeble mutter of,
"Going to have a cup of tea,"
trailed away into nothingness. They looked at each other helplessly, then followed Lockhart and his healer along the corridor.
"Let's not stay long," Ron said quietly.
The healer pointed her wand at the door of the Janus Thickey ward and muttered,
"Aloha Mora."
The door swung open, and she led the way inside, keeping a firm grasp on Gilderoy's arm until she had settled him into an armchair beside his bed.
"This is our long-term residence ward,"
she informed Harry, Ron, Hermione and Ginny in a low voice.
"For permanent spell damage, you know. Of course, with intensive remedial potions and charms and a bit of luck, we can produce some improvement. Gilderoy does seem to be getting back some sense of himself, and we've seen a real improvement in Mr. Bode. He seems to be regaining the power of speech very well, though he isn't speaking any language we recognise yet. Well, I must finish giving out the Christmas presents. I'll leave you all to chat."
Harry looked around. The ward bore unmistakable signs of being a permanent home to its residents. They had many more personal effects around their beds than in Mr. Weasley's ward. The wall around Gilderoy's headboard, for instance, was papered with pictures of himself, all beaming toothily and waving at the new arrivals. He had autographed many of them to himself, in disjointed, childish writing. The moment he had been deposited in his chair by the healer, Gilderoy pulled a fresh stack of photographs towards him, seized a quill, and started signing them all feverishly.
"You can put them in envelopes," he said to Ginny, throwing the signed pictures into her lap, one by one, as he finished them. "I'm not forgotten, you know."
"No.
I still receive a very great deal of fan mail. Gladys Gudgeon writes weekly. I just wish I knew why."
He paused, looking faintly puzzled, then beamed again and returned to his signing with renewed vigour.
"I suspect it's simply my good looks."
A sallow-skinned, mournful-looking wizard lay in the bed opposite, staring at the ceiling. He was mumbling to himself and seemed quite unaware of anything around him. Two beds along was a woman whose entire head was covered in fur. Harry remembered something similar happening to Hermione during their second year, although fortunately the damage in her case had not been permanent. At the far end of the ward, flowery curtains had been drawn around two beds to give the occupants and their visitors some privacy.
"Here you are, Agnes," said the healer brightly to the furry-faced woman, handing her a small pile of Christmas presents. "See, not forgotten, are you? And your son sent an owl to say he's visiting tonight.
so that's nice, isn't it?
Agnes gave several loud barks.
And look, Broderick, you've been sent a pot plant and a lovely calendar with a different fancy hippogriff for each month. They'll brighten things up, won't they?
Said the healer, bustling along to the mumbling man, setting a rather ugly plant with long, swaying tentacles on the bedside cabinet, and fixing the calendar to the wall with her wand.
And, oh, Mrs. Longbottom, are you leaving already? Harry's head span round.
The curtains had been drawn back from the two beds at the end of the ward, and two visitors were walking back down the aisle between the beds. A formidable-looking old witch, wearing a long green dress, a moth-eaten fox fur, and a pointed hat decorated with what was unmistakably a stuffed vulture, and, trailing behind her, looking thoroughly depressed, Neville.